Senate Revenue Committee Agenda, February 11th, 1981, 1:30 p.m., Hearing Room 137, Econometric Model, Executive Department.
Bob Smith today. Will you take the position? Is everyone ready to go?
Let her in.
You have 1:30?
Yes, it's 1:35.
Okay, the meeting's come to order. The clerk will note those present and those not. We're ready to go, and Senator Powell is now here. Are all your people here?
No, sir.
Yes, they are.
Yes, sir. Oh, you don't sneak up and back on me like that?
Morning. Hey, the committee, we're all here today. We're talking about the econometric model. And we have people from the executive department here have been working on it for some time.
Address the foolproofness of your model and why you're doing it, justifying your expense.
Show this to Powell. Powell, this is what happens to you.
Yeah, you don't mess around with it.
Holy cow. You a doctor?
One thing I do know, she knows English, speaks English well.
She probably speaks it well, she can write it well.
I think he'd get the message.
Yeah. He also gave me
He sent an apple with it.
With a bottle on top.
Well, I think he had practiced that speech for a couple days and was so intent on pulling it off just right that he didn't want it.
He knew there was a Mac involved.
That's what he said. I told him today, I said, thanks for the apple and you're forgiven this time. He said, I said, but don't make that mistake again. He says, from now on, I'll call you back.
Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Robert Smith, Director of the Executive Department. With me is Dr. Ed Moskovich, Vice President for Regional Economics of Data Resources Incorporated, based in Massachusetts, and Dr. Chang Song, State Econometrician from the Executive Department. As I understand it, we've been asked to appear before you to brief the committee on the history and development and current status of the econometric modeling effort that will in one phase be used to assist us in forecasting general fund revenues and others. There are also other advantages to it. To begin, I'd like to just outline for you the history of the development of this project. As you know, Mr. Chairman, it started 2 years ago this coming May when Governor Tee authorized us to begin a consideration of alternatives to our traditional revenue forecasting methods. Early in June, Mr. Moskovich, who among other things in his past lives has been a state budget officer and understands the practicality and dangers of inaccurate revenue forecasting, came to Oregon at my request, met with various persons, the chairman of the Senate and House Revenues and Ways and Means Committees, the chiefs of the professional legislative, fiscal, and revenue staffs, persons from the Executive Department, within the Executive Department, Department of Revenue, and the governor's executive assistant. He then gave us a little report in June, late June, outlining the dangers and advantages of econometric modeling and the various kinds of alternatives that existed at that time. We moved ahead, and in September 1979, the Emergency Board approved the authorization of funds for the establishment of a position and reserved funds for additional funds to develop a model. In February, after a nationwide search, we hired Chang Song from our own Department of Revenue. typical cases, you go through a two-month national search, and sure enough, there's somebody in your backyard that can do the job. He's done an outstanding job. Since early February, we have had an informal group of internal advisory committee, as I like to think of it, of state employed economists and others. Their first job was to assist in the development of an RFP to gain a contractor. An internal model like this has to have some kind of base on the national economy driving it and interacting with it.
Excuse me, but RFP, I missed.
Request for proposal. Okay. It's a technically not a bid for a low bid, okay, but it's the same thing where you state in some specifics what it is you want to purchase from a contractor of some kind, and then there is an evaluation of those proposals.
Thank you, John.
We had, excuse me, I try to stay away from jargon. We had seven proposals, if I remember correctly. We sent out to seven firms that had expressed interest, and three submitted proposals. They were the big three of the economy forecasting business in this country. It's Chase Econometrics, Wharton, and DRI, Data Resources Incorporated. After consideration of the selection committee, the award was made to Data Resources Incorporated. One of the principal things about Data Resources is that they are, of the three, the one that handles almost all of the state advice and forecasting. They have full services with 13 states, a total of 27 states that they do business with. Only one of the other two have full services to states for their efforts, and it has only two.
Okay, so now, from now on, DRI, it means the
Data
the firm.
Resources Incorporated.
Okay.
We, as you can see in the chronology that's been passed out to you all the way through the spring, summer, the development of the technical model has gone on with consultation with our Data Resources Incorporated staff assisting, and various persons within state government, including the Legislative Revenue Office and the Legislative Fiscal Office. The first model production has taken place on a preliminary basis. If you look at the chart that I put there, we now foresee that four times a year this model will produce a forecast and a comparison of actual to previously forecast data on the elements of the economy. Those forecasts will take place in February, May, August, and November of each year.
Bob, why not March, June, August, and November?
I can't answer that question, Mr. Chairman. Why did you pick February?
Okay, the reason we picked February and May, for instance, May, we will have first quarter actually in May, so we want to compare our forecast against the first quarter actual in May.
Okay.
So that's why
That's why you bring it right on.
We have a month to accumulate final information. We have a month in January to accumulate the final elements of the economy through the end of December. It does fit in rather nicely with the once a year April 15 problem, because the final stage is in week four when we would be overlaying, and then it takes absolutely no time, literally a couple of minutes, to get that final forecast after we've made our judgments.
But following, now I'm assuming that week one begins after you have the information. For example, in the forecast that we're going to get here in March, we're waiting to, or the one that will be in June, you're waiting for the mailbags and that sort of thing. Will they be able to take some of that information into consideration
yes,
in dealing with elasticity in May?
I hasten to add, we have two forecasting systems in place in the state of Oregon right now.
Mm-hmm.
One is the quote traditional, that's Paul Egger, and one is this new effort.
Mm.
Now, Paul has been consulted from day one all the way through. He has the product of all our work as soon as we do, and he is using it. And we are making special efforts to coordinate so that the kinds of indices that the full model uses are being converted into what he has measured in the past. But that first week is an internal week where we crank the machine up. Chang and others informally will be reviewing the results for common sense and checking against other approaches. The rule of thumb of ERISA, is it? Not ERISA, what's that?
ARIMA.
ARIMA.
You're a little off in territory. Pensions right now.
Well, yeah, or whatever. It is a catch word that economists know about to just check, hey, has the thing gone tilt on us? The next step in during week two is the inside group. Now, we have two formally established advisory groups to keep the computer from trying to think for itself or even change, and us thinking for ourselves. The first, the formal name is the inside group. It has an informal name of the Executive Department Econometric Model Advisory Committee. The members of that have been distributed to you. They include the economists, chief planners from most of the major state agencies, and representatives from both of the legislative revenue and legislative fiscal staffs. The duties of that advisory committee are to, one, provide input to the executive department's econometric model, basic data in some cases. Provide advice on variables and specifications within the model. Check the reasonableness of preliminary forecasting results, specifically once a quarter during week two. They will meet at least that often to interact with everything we've been able to find out to date.
Mr. Chairman, I think we probably already know this, but refresh my memory. Are we going to get this information from you at some time in March, or are we going to not get anything until June?
You will get a revenue forecast, which at this point will be made by Mr. Paul Egger in March, to be justified by him after he'll be consulting this. You will also get the full model production, which is actually two models. It is a model of the economy of this state in very great detail, both historically, beginning in 1972, and for 20 quarters, or 5 years into the future. You will get that, and you will get the output of the tax yield conversion model that will be driven by the model of the economy. You're going to have a book that thick that's going to tell you more than any one of us want to know. Now, this is just a test, you know, this first model. And as I've said from the first time I appeared for any legislative committee a year and a half ago, I don't know when the reliability of our modeling effort and the credibility of that effort will, you know, when it will take over. I do know that these things take years they are never perfected. They are a constantly changing, dynamic effort, and it will be some time.
Okay, now, will we get in May the benefit of the econometric model prior to the June estimate from Paul?
It'll be about the same time, okay, as we've reported previously.
Because of the four-week delay
in it'll be about the end of May. We won't delay when we are finally satisfied, you know, in week four.
So Paul's estimate in June is going to come out about the same time as this one?
That's totally coincidental. Well, it isn't coincidental because we're all driving off of a close of a quarter of data. Both systems are. They have to. It's when the new information is available is when you get
that's,
in.
I guess that went back to the questions of why it was going to take that long for Paul to produce his estimate, when in fact you've got a system here that I'm not sure he might use this system now that it's in place. He might run it through the advisory committee or the governor's council or something. I don't know what he's going to do, but if you can get the data together, get it into the computer, and then wait 4 weeks to hand it over, it seems like his gyration should be able to come out in mid-May.
Well, the 4 weeks, we aren't waiting. There's a tremendous amount of analysis.
Okay, so you won't get the product and then start week one. Well, yes, you will.
No, we produce a test.
Okay.
All right. Now, what does it mean? What is happening? It takes these groups of advisory, and if I could go through, and especially to the outside group here next. But anyway, This inside group exists, and they will be advising us.
Senator Trill had a question for you.
A couple of questions. One related to the months you have down. We'll get that information first of those months or the middle of the month? Or the end
at
of
the close of the month.
Close of each of the
month. Yes.
Did you say that? I don't know that you
no.
said that.
No, but in week four is when we will issue final forecast.
Okay. So you're going to go through this process beginning in February, at the close of the month we will.
Yes, yes. Now then, and there is no exact date when that is, but as soon as we feel comfortable that we have
gotten. Second question has to do with the relationship of Mr. Eggers and his forecasting with the econometric model. Is he now using the data from the, is he's privy to the data from the econometric model so that that may in effect influence what he's doing?
He is privy to everything within the model.
Okay, so we're not getting two independent forecasts then. We have to bounce against each other. We're getting the econometric model, which is an independent one. Mr. Eggers is balancing his based on what's coming out.
I can't speak to that. It is an independent forecast in that we, as we never have, tried to say this is what you should forecast. But
will his forecasting technique then be significantly different than it has been in the past? Will he bounce his forecasting technique through this process of review?
He won't be driving it through the model per se, no.
Will he go through the review of letting other economists check his?
No, he never has.
He would not do that.
I can't say that, no.
But you're not asking him to know, even if you comment. It seems to me that what you're doing for the econometric model and that forecast is to give it a lot more credibility than Mr. Eggers will have simply because of the checking that you've done with it.
That's exactly what Governor Attia wants to do. We want to open this total process up so that everyone can second guess us. Every member of this committee can look at those indexes, and this is what's going to happen in lumber employment. And you see it quarter by quarter by quarter by 5 years.
Also, it makes Mr. Eggers, I think, fairly safe since he's privy to what the econometric model is doing in his own forecasting. I mean, it gives him a certain advantage that he didn't have.
My only purpose is to get the best possible revenue forecast for this state.
That's what we want.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, go on and describe the purposes of the Governor's Council.
Before we go,
one thing I think that happens, even if he's privy to it, he may challenge it for other reasons and show us the challenge that we want to listen to.
But I think he ought to challenge it and then go to the real experts with it through that process.
That's us.
Well, here, the point being that we're not going to get the traditional versus the econometric model because they're sharing data that heretofore was not available.
We are not, we are not trying to force the two results.
No,
to be
I understand
identical.
That, but it will affect the outcome. I'm convinced that if he gets a packet of information that deep from the computer, that's going to affect his outcome somewhat. Now, perhaps he's in such line with all the assumptions that have been plugged into the computer that they're going to come out pretty close anyway. But I do think that it will keep us. Now, did you run one in February that he got?
Preliminary ones, he's had it.
Okay.
The Governor's Council of Economic Advisors is a group of 10 very, very eminent economists. I think of them as the vice presidents for economics of all the major financial and industrial and business concerns in Oregon. That roster has been distributed to you. We had the first meeting of the council yesterday. Its basic purpose is to review and discuss alternative national economic forecasts. We get from DRI each quarter their national economic forecast. That reflects the thinking of their president. But we want this group of internal economists to review this forecast and help us determine the national economic assumptions that will actually be used in driving the state economic forecast. In addition to that, we want them to review that preliminary state economic forecast provided by us and to discuss recent developments in the state economy and the impact of those recent developments on the short-term economic outlook for Oregon. And then also to individually or collectively provide advice and criticism on the methodology or dissemination of the quarterly economy and revenue forecast made by the Executive Department. We had our first meeting yesterday. It worked out more valuably than I had dreamed in my fondest dreams for a first meeting. This group of 10, each one of them knew two or three of the others because they're basically in the same business. But they took the model. It was a preliminary. They had it for about a week and had some very significant criticisms, comments, questions. The results that will finally be coming out will be amended by us because of the comments. Specifically, the agricultural economist from OSU, Bill Brown, just pointed out that the agricultural index that is built in there was not optimistic enough. Similarly, several of them, including the representative for the manager of economics for Tektronix, pointed out that high-tech employment will increase at a faster rate than the model had shown because they're just, I think, what was the phrase, dismantling or disassembling or... They're overloaded down in Santa Clara County, and that form of employment is so. And that's, you'll get it from Ed here in a minute, much better than I can, but this thing has proven very, very valuable already just in this first test run. Paul was there during the entire thing, as I was there most of the time. Jim Scherzinger from your staff was there much of it, and one of the things, these are under our law because it is an executive order body, it has to be held in a public meeting, and it's kind of regrettable because one of the things we hope to get is the bank vice president for economics, whose public corporate posture is everything is rosy, but when he's coming in and talking to us and saying, well, really, that's not it. My corporate posture is one thing, but my professional judgment as an economist is something else. We did have, and I was very pleased, that we had a full and open discussion. They disagreed. You know, we had 10 economists in the room. We had 27 clear opinions on each item that was discussed, and that's exactly what we want. Neither of these advisory groups are decision-making bodies. We don't vote. We hope there will be a consensus or be arrived at as to what the best course of action is. I'm the one that gets the spears. Executive Department, the governor is responsible, and that's the way it is.
Mr. Chairman. Okay, Senator Instead.
Yeah. How many states have this, Bob?
Most states that have an econometric model have some kind of advisory group. I know that the state of Michigan has a pretty good modeling effort. Their director of the Executive Department is a PhD in economics, and I call him and say, what kind of advisory group? He said, none, I wouldn't let him in on it. Well, most of them do. They come in various shades and types. Some of them have a three-person body. Some of them, well, he did. That's what he told me. Yeah, you can just picture.
California have such a model.
Oh, yeah.
In your wildest dream, I mean, when this is all in place, and if your wildest dreams come true, what percentage of accuracy can anybody hope for?
Oh, it depends on the assumptions. Please.
I know all your assumptions are. percentage of your assumptions are going to be right? I mean,
Ed can talk to it, and his macro forecast at the national level is about 1% error. And this is what I've talked to with other people who have gone into this. Within a couple of years of experience, they can. But remember that an econometric model is nothing other than using a computer to do mathematical calculations fast. It is not a panacea. It will not think for you, and it will not guarantee results. It will produce anything we put into it.
Well, let me ask Senator Jernstedt's question a different way. This year, and I guess I'm talking to Ed, this year around the country,
were you within 1% more than not?
On tax revenues with our state clients? They often don't keep track or tell me, but I'd say certainly within 2%. It'd be very unusual not to be within 2%.
And how far off are we really ending up from our estimate? 7%?
Depends on when you say the estimate was made. Well, what the starting point?
Figure June of prior to this budget.
Oh, at the end of the session?
June of 79.
Well, that's there was no benchmark on what the legislature finally did. I'm not trying to be evasive at all, but that.
Let's go with Mr. Eggers.
Eggers at the adopted budget, and that is after the yield problem showed up, which was $50 million worth, which doesn't show up, but that's a clear change. It was $204 million difference on a base of 2.8 billion, so that's about 8 to 10% miss.
We add the 50 million and off. Yeah.
Now, defending Mr. Egger, the basic thrust, the broad-based economic assumptions upon which this biennium's revenue forecast was based did not anticipate the steep recession of the spring of 1980. No consensus. DRI wasn't forecasting that depth of recession either.
I guess that was my point. Where would we be had we had this econometric model in place when, in fact, people were expecting a possible tightening of credit before it happened and a loosening about the time it actually started tightening? They expected presidential politics as usual. We didn't get it. Where would we be? Could we expect at this point to be better off as a result of having this model in place?
If we'd had it operational for 2 years, I don't think there's any question about it. First of all, the yield problem would not have been there. Secondly, the legislature, in your considerations 2 years ago, could have done a more precise job and a much more accurate job of as you were playing your what-if games, and when you were balancing the budget in the last month. And thirdly, the dip and the problems that started showing up in the economy, we would have had 6 months earlier information on that. Because it would have started to show up, and we're looking at that thing and said, oh my God, this first quarter isn't coming up to the employment that we expected. Look at that. And we would have had 6 months earlier information that we were in trouble. So I don't think there's any question. We would have been far greater off with this, no matter what the assumptions are. First of all, again, the yield problem is not there.
Okay, now on the question of yield, it's not there for what reason?
Because with the refined mathematical formulae that go into yield that are kept within that computer and known to everybody, you can every month review it, and you don't just change a multiplier or the elasticity factor by a huge amount. You can quarter by quarter and month by month adjust to realities as it develops. You have a permanent written record of where you thought you were going to, what you thought was going to happen, and it's never gone away. You have that permanent record, and you are comparing with it both on the elements of economic activity and on the actual yield factors. You can, with precision and certainty, analyze backward then when something goes wrong, other than what you forecast, and determine exactly, is it because of a change in the economy, or is it because in the tax yield formulas? We've never known in the past. I don't know yet how much of that $50 million was yield, how much was a little less. I don't think anybody in this room does. I don't think anybody in the world does. Because we didn't have an accurate roadmap to start with. But again, as I was starting to say, this model is only as good as the minds and the human subjective judgment that is applied to it for forecasting. That's where the outside advisory group comes in.
Senator Trump.
How many assumptions are we putting into the economic model?
The number of assumptions. I don't know. Perhaps we should, you're getting into the model per se, Mr. Chairman.
Ed has.
Okay. Yeah, really.
Is that okay, Senator Trow?
I
think it will come.
So we get to the guts of the model.
Yeah, because because the point I want to make is that I think all of the assumptions, assuming there are quite a number of them that are put in, are also, the weighting of the assumptions is known by this group of experts, and the equations are checkable and so forth.
Absolutely.
All of that is out. And before, with the other system, we really only got a very vague statement about assumptions. We never really saw them. We never saw the weighting of them or the equations or anything. So at least this is a checkable system we can look at.
This will make 90 experts, right?
No, it won't. But it will make it possible. It will make it possible for each one of you to understand what the assumptions are in common language, and assuming some buildup of experience of the real technical experts on the conversions that these formulae provide, you know what it is you're assuming and basing your decisions on.
Assumptions are clearly laid out.
Plain language.
Actual numbers. Yeah. And the arithmetic process by which you go from those assumptions to results is clear and open. And if you do the same assumptions a second time, you get the same results.
But if you change assumptions, you're going to get different results. There's another thing I'd like to say about this. These models raise more questions than they provide answers. But that's good.
Sure.
That is good. They do raise more questions. He's going up to Olympia tomorrow, and we'll go back through it. Sometime next week, we will push the button and produce a report.
Well, your information on the electronics industry is quite correct, because they are so boxed in down there. I just spent a week and a half down that area. There's no question Washington and Oregon are going to reap some mighty benefits, because they have nowhere.
There's one other thing that I keep reading in the papers that you don't have in your model, and that's just gas and oil exploration. We got so doggone many permits where they run in here with an oil rig, and we're going to pick up some income tax from that. I'm sure it's not enough to measure in the model, but just the exploration, we haven't hit much.
One thing you ought to know about natural gas, do you realize that Oregon produces 25% of their use right today from those mist wells?
I didn't.
Good.
Is that high?
That's right.
Good Lord.
Yes,
the mist well, the mist well is totally consumed by one industry.
I didn't say that. I'm saying that the production that fine produces would supply 25% of our needs, not that we're using it necessarily. Okay? That's what I've been told.
The mist well would supply 25% of all the total demand for natural gas in Oregon right now. Well, that's far from what I've heard.
That's really true.
I've heard it just barely runs the fertilizer manufacturing outfit.
They've got several.
We're doing something for a pipeline across the eastern Oregon. Yeah, we're building a major pipeline across eastern Oregon just to work on that.
Yeah, that really surprised me, because I went to a deal where the guy from that organization had pie charts and everything.
Well, and they're building a pipeline.
You get your answer to the question about the tax model. I mean, mechanically it runs, and there'll be numbers soon.
Dr. Son, anything you wanted to add to this discussion?
Why, thank you, Mark.
Well, if it is permissible, I rather wait until we the permission official first proposed.
Yeah, that's
a week or so. I have just through Rich Mund had been asked to comment to you on both the structure of the model and our short-term outlook, and I'd be perfectly happy either to do that or not to do that, as you prefer.
Repeat that: the structure of the model and the short-term.
The DRI short-term forecast.
Nationally.
I'd not be offended to have you say you want to wait.
Nationally, yeah, we'd like to hear it.
Basically, what we're forecasting is a recession this spring, and rather slow recovery in the second half and into 82, and then another cycle in 83. And the reasons for that are that real income is falling this spring. actually the same as it has been falling all along, a combination of big Social Security tax increases and increases in energy costs on the one hand, and as Oregon knows, certainly the effect of very high interest rates on auto sales and housing starts. This second recession gets turned off in the summer on the assumption that Congress enacts something like a 10% income tax cut effective July 1st, which will set off a mild increase in consumer spending. And also, the kind of cycle that the Federal Reserve seems to have us in, that with this fixed growth in the money supply, high interest rates will slow up the economy, which will produce low interest rates, which will speed up the economy. The question then comes next fall, as the economy begins to grow, through some combination of decreased inflation and increased productivity, could the economy take off without colliding with the Federal Reserve? Our answer is no. And I think the President's answer is yes. Given our answer, what
now,
would
you repeat the collision?
As the economy begins to grow, with the Federal Reserve holding to a very limited increase in the money supply, in order to accommodate the growth in the economy, you have to have a big increase in the velocity of money. Well, I left out a step. The economy grows in real terms. That gets multiplied by a price rate, price increase, to get to an increase in nominal economy. And then there's some sort of ratio. The velocity of money, in effect, is the ratio between the amount of money and the nominal GNP.
So you say that the Fed would have to, at that point, provide more money?
Well, I think the President's assumption is that his new program would cause increased productivity and decreased inflation in such a way that the increased real economy will not, in fact, will not be accompanied by higher prices, and therefore the growth will not be great in money terms, and there will then not be a collision with the Federal Reserve. Our forecast is that that won't happen. That is, that inflation won't drop as much as he says. Therefore, there will be a collision with the Federal Reserve. That will drive up interest rates, which will slow up the economy, mainly housing, and therefore certainly slow up the Oregon economy in 1983.
Okay.
Now,
Mr. Chairman, given that theory, if the Federal Reserve Board, and I followed Volcker's activities more than just, he is saying, though, if he sees a restraint by action in the Congress, that means to reduce their spending efforts, to control that, Federal Reserve Board may indeed respond differently if they feel they have someone assisting them in their efforts, not just playing control of inflation entirely the board. You believe that he isn't going to follow that particular course? You think he still will not give that a chance to work? You think that if he sees that he is not going to be willing to work to keep that money supply at a higher ratio, even though maybe some inflation?
I don't want to claim to be a Volcker watcher.
No, I know. But you have to be watching somebody.
Yes.
He's the one pulling the string.
I guess my answer to that would be twofold. First of all, my guess is that he is committed to a 6.5%, I think is the figure, increase in the money supply, and that he is going to do that. He got burned pretty badly last summer because when he succeeded in slowing the economy spring of 1980, he then let the money supply grow at a very fast rate for a couple of quarters and got interest rates below the rate of inflation and a whole lot of other things, and I don't think he's going to let that happen again.
Well, the only thing I think the difference is you saw a continued growth in spending.
Well, let me address the second half of your question, and that is there is one theory which says that the composition of spending as opposed to the overall amount makes a difference. Certainly in the medium run, it's true that if you have more capital formation than 2 years from now, you'll be better off than if you don't. I certainly subscribe to that. But in the short run, if the Congress, if the president cuts off domestic spending, social programs, as he certainly intends to try, and then either sets off a consumption boom by a big cut in personal spending, or a big increase in military spending, or more likely, both, you're still going to have too much aggregate demand. And the fact that more of it is in the military and private consumption and less of it in federal domestic spending doesn't seem to me that it's any less inflationary. I mean, I just think looking at what the president has committed himself to, he's committed himself to big tax increases, which it's easy to see if he...
Tax cuts. Have me a little concerned.
Right, I'm sorry. He's committed himself to big tax cuts, a visible promise. He's committed himself to big cuts in domestic spending, always tougher to do than to say. And he's committed himself to an increase in the military budget. My guess is easier to start than to turn off. My own view is that we are likely to have near accomplishment of the tax cuts, under accomplishment of the domestic spending cuts, and over accomplishment of the military increase. That will lead to much more pressure. For one thing, it won't lead to a particular increase in capital formation, so it won't improve productivity all that much. But it certainly will lead to a lot of aggregate demand, which means that that 6.5% money target will bite hard, which means, and in effect, all of that excess aggregate demand comes out of capital formation, largely housing. So in effect, you all are sitting at the tail end of this whole process.
I kind of understood that before you talked.
Yeah.
The only thing is that if he is successful in dipping into the spending for social, if he is successful on his target,
only if he doesn't. Only if he doesn't use it for domestic, for personal tax cuts or the military. If he uses it for personal tax cuts or the military, then it may make some difference in terms of your social views, but it's still aggregate demand that's not going to capital formation.
And I think another way of demonstrating that is that the continual talk about balancing the budget, it doesn't happen. Because just as you point out, it's easier to talk about those cuts than to get them. And when you're talking about cuts, you've got to give something else somewhere. And ultimately, the first word from any new administration, what was the Carter administration or the Reagan administration, the day after they take power, they say it won't be 3 years. And then when you're in the second year, they say it'll be in the fifth year, right after I'm reelected, that will balance the budget, because those things continue to be postponed for the reasons you just pointed out. And I would tend to agree that that would probably happen again. If you spend the money, you spend the money. And it would skew it somewhat depending on where you spend it. But if you're buying goods from people that have a near monopoly on the production of those goods, you're probably going to spend more money than you projected to spend.
You mean the military?
Senator Trump. If we could balance the budget 1 year, would that necessarily help us get inflation under control?
Well, there's two things it could do. One is by decreasing the federal borrowing, it would certainly ease up the money markets and allow lower interest rates, which I think would help some. Some people argue that above and beyond that, it has a symbolic importance. You know, that behavior, private investment behavior, depends not just on real magnitudes, but on confidence. I don't know, there's a whole lot of evidence for that.
It depends on what you do to balance the budget. If you increase taxes, it's one thing. If you cut spending on certain kinds of programs, you maybe increase unemployment, things like that.
Well, I did some simulations about 6 months ago with the DRI model, and in fact, the best thing you can do is to cut federal programs and put it into capital formation. I mean, the most powerful thing you can do is to shorten depreciation allowances and increase the investment tax credit, because those things go right to capital formation, and they do increase productivity and they do increase capacity 2 years out, so that you don't have this bumping up of production against capacity quite so quickly.
I see that happening politically.
Well, to some extent, sure. I mean, the president is going to make what on the whole seem like desirable changes in those laws, but I guess I would worry that he's going to lose control of the budget and that he's going to push up interest rates pretty high. He's not going to intend to, but it sure is awfully likely.
You think interest rates lead to inflation? There's a catch-22 by using the interest rate as one of the inflation.
Sure. Both in the short term, because it goes into the CPI, even though not everybody buys a new house every month, a lot of wages and prices and Social Security and everything else are based on compensating people for that inflation that they didn't quite feel.
This is an outstanding thing I just saw again today. 32% of all federal outlays are indexed to the CPI.
Which overstates the impact of interest rates.
And that's,
But it's worse than that, because in the long term, when you use interest rates to control inflation, then what you're also doing is cutting down on capital formation. So,
well, I was going to point that out, because if you borrow at that rate, you're subscribing to, if we use an interest rates, and even if we went into agreeing to put more capital formation out there, as people try to increase their productivity, it's almost a negligible effect because of the interest rates they're having to pay for the monetary investment.
Sure.
I just went through a facility here recently where, no question, their productivity is higher, but they're just being eaten alive because of the interest rates they had to pay for the capital formation.
And therefore they won't do it again.
That's right. That's right.
So that goes back to your question. Lower interest rates for a long period of time will certainly help people to think farther into the future. And psychologically, I should have thought, are very important.
See that? Do you think that any kind of constitutional amendment which would impel a balanced budget every year is economically a possibility? The constitutional amendment is probably a possibility, but could we operate, could we balance the budget every year?
Every year, no. If you tried to balance it every year, you couldn't control unemployment and inflation. You'd be throwing away a big, important tool.
So it's really not realistic to think that. How often can you balance the budget, do you think, economically?
Oh, I guess the theory is you're supposed to try to balance it over the cycle. And then you get into some arcane bits of economic theory. Under certain circumstances, you wouldn't need to. But I think you are putting your finger on a good point, which is because it's easier to it's hard to control the budget. We always do seem to fight inflation through monetary policy as opposed to fiscal policy, which is the wrong way to do it and is self-defeating. And we ought to look for some way of getting out of that. Personally wouldn't do it the way you suggested, but I think I certainly agree with your analysis of the problem.
Senator Monroe.
I take it you don't accept the economic theories of, is it Laffer?
Laffer?
Yeah, Laffer.
Oh, that's not quite true. I think the theory is essentially correct, but his interpretation of where we are on the curve is wrong. The Laffer curve says that at some point, if you raise the tax rate, the amount of revenue you get will come down. But I don't think we're anywhere near there yet.
Yeah. Second question I have relative to speculating about inflation and what causes inflation. How significant a factor is our balance of trade deficit, and balance of payments deficit in the whole inflationary picture? And what could be done if that is a significant factor? Hope you say it is, because I think it is. What are some things that could be done to reduce that?
I think, to be honest, I haven't thought about that one since for about 3 or 4 years, and I hesitate to do it on a 10-second notice. There's a certain theory I want to think through about the way foreign trade works on the economy and so on. One thing. Part of the problem, certainly pretty unambiguous, is that we have this huge bill for imported energy, and we're paying an awful lot more money for the same amount of goods. That does have to be inflationary. I mean, if you think of inflation as basically how much demand is chasing how many goods, we have less around. We have to send out more real goods in terms of exports to pay for the same amount of energy. So in that sense, the balance of payments, that partial answer is certainly true.
But we're exporting dollars.
No, we export goods. It takes more.
But I mean, when we have a balance of trade deficit, that's an outflow of dollars.
I'm sorry, I was making a different point.
Yeah.
It takes us, we have to send abroad more real goods,
mm-hmm.
more corn and whatever else we export.
For the same amount of oil.
Yeah. The same amount of oil. But we have just as many people growing the corn and making the computers. Only now there isn't, and they get paid, and there aren't as many goods against that payment.
Yeah.
You know, you're saying the fact that we have a deficit, in fact, is inflationary. I'm not sure that's really true. We sell abroad less than we buy. So you could argue, in fact, that we're borrowing. In effect, what we're doing is borrowing from the rest of the world. And as long as they want to keep lending to us, it probably is anti-inflationary, isn't it?
Okay. Ed, if you will, in summary now, through the first part of 81, slow, interest rates are going to go down in the second half of 81 or first part of 82?
Interest rates should begin to fall within the next couple of months from around 18, I guess, on the prime rate to around 14. They'll fall just because the economy has slowed down.
Okay, they're going to fall then in late 82. We're going to start getting another slowing because of tight money policy, because of the confrontation you see. And by 83, it'll be cool again, and the economy here will be suffering in the housing area in particular and
right.
all the related fields.
Right.
So a very short lived recovery.
Yes, and at substantially slower rates than past recoveries, both nationally and in Oregon. Nothing like the 4 or 5% real growth nationally that we had in 76. So in the actual second slowdown or third slowdown comes in 83, but even throughout late 81 and late 82, recovery is slower than it would have been that many quarters past the trough, the bottom of the cycle. In any other cycle. So you're feeling that collision at all times. You know, instead of like that, you're like this.
Well, in the housing area, even at 14%, you're really pressed.
Bob and I both agree that we can never buy another house.
Yeah. I think that's, unless you're a veteran in Oregon, and that's why I opposed and confining the number of loans they could get, and we should undo that mistake, simply because the demand's going to be there. You can't qualify. I think right now you got to have an income about $32,000 to afford a $60,000 house, and to qualify right now in a private lending institution. And 14% prime is not going to unthaw that problem. And in essence, that recovery in late 81 and into 82 isn't going to be a very steep one, as you point out. It's going to be a little bubble.
The advisors yesterday thought, if anything, that DRI's macro forecast was a little optimistic, and they thought that the kind of high interest rates we forecast implied a slower economic growth.
Yes. Okay. Senator?
One quick question. You have models that study worldwide trends, and then be able to say we're going to stay out of war or we're not going to stay out of war, which would throw the whole thing into a cocktail.
Well, the macro model with its 800 or 900 equations got a lot of levers to play with. So you can,
Senator Jernstedt, in a true partisan way, now that there's a Republican president, you know we're not going to war for at least 4 years.
I didn't say that.
Oh, okay. I just heard that somewhere. Senator Hamill.
The problems you describe are typical of Western industrial nations. Is there any one nation that's suffering these problems that is closer to a solution than the others? If so, what might be one or two dominant factors in that?
That's quite a question. I suppose if I had to guess quickly, I'd say Japan and Germany.
Why?
Well, larger percent of GNP and a capital formation is one reason. And another reason is a greater willingness on everybody to look farther ahead. I think that...
But look at their energy picture. Japan has got their energy pictures isn't even, it's so much worse than ours.
They've made allowances for that.
They probably have contracts against our energy supply for the next 400 years to the point where they're going to get
them. They're getting them.
And no significant defense expenditure.
But it comes down to the quality of the nation.
Well, people in Japan, both businessmen and individuals, put a lot more emphasis on the future than we do. Individuals save more, and businessmen invest more.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Very useful.